about the issues that are going on in the labor community and about working folks and where they, you know, the issues that they're working on. But this is what KBOO is all about. We bring people who are in the trenches doing amazing things there and are working to overturn sneak attacks on the affordability of your communities, on the wages that we need to have keep pace with expenses. So that is important. And I love to listen to Labor Radio. Always interesting people there. Labor Radio, Prison Pipeline coming right up. But before they do, give us a call, toll free 877-500-5266.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Tonight we'll be listening to a talk given last July at the Socialism 2016 conference in Chicago on the rank and file strategy for trade unions.
So there's going to be basically three main sections to my presentation. The first is going to be describing what the rank and file strategy is. Secondly, what is the historical record of this strategy? And thirdly, and briefly, would be how can we apply it today as activists such as it is. So first, on what is the rank and file strategy, I think in a nutshell, it stems from a Marxist analysis of trade unions. And there's going to be a session, I believe, on later in the future on that very question, Marxism and trade unions, I think either tomorrow or Monday. But basically, trade unions play a contradictory role in capitalism. On the one hand, they represent the interests of the working classes, of the working class. They express the resistance of the working class to capitalist exploitation. And at the same sense, they also negotiate exploitation under capitalism. So it means they contain the resistance. They come at the end of a negotiation, you come to an agreement with the boss about the conditions of work. And so it is at the same time both the agency of conflict and accommodation with capital. And so it has a contradictory nature inherent to it. And so the bureaucracy or the officials within the trade union structure, and especially currently, often have a vested interest in the continuation of the status quo because that's how they make their living. The worst case examples are too many, unfortunately. One that I could mention would be an individual named Frank Soule. I don't know if he's dead yet, but he's Layton's former president of the International Brother Teamsters Local 710 here in the Chicago area. He was pulling down $400,000 a year with his own, between his own salary, his international salary, and his area vice president salary, whatever the hell. And so this guy was obviously much closer to the 1% than he was to the 99%. And it showed in his practice. I mean, the workers he represented at UPS 97 scabbed on the strike. The workers worked at the Rockford Air Hub, and that was the one hub that continued to move freight for UPS during their strike. And their workers made $8.50 an hour, while Frank was pulling down $400,000. So anyway, the union bureaucracy, in the worst case, demos have identify with the system, actually, because they can that's how they make their living. And they must solve conflicts within the framework of capitalism, because trade unions are that's what their role is. And they're also wedded politically to the Democratic Party. For example, my own union, however progressive it is, was a big supporter of Bernie Sanders. And I think in some ways, was outside the usual, you know, Democratic Party support that most unions gave. Like I know the Weingarten and the AFT was supporting Clinton, I think 10 years ago probably for president, but endorsed her very early. And so even though even left-wing unions like National Nurses United got behind Bernie, they had a big event for him actually in this very building about 2 weeks ago to talk about what are the next steps, and they still keep it very within the bounds of the Democratic Party. And the Roseanne DeMauro, who's the director or whatever of my union, basically said, we have to get rid of Trump. And implicit within that is that we basically have to vote for Clinton. So even left-wing trade union leaders still support Democrats. And so the union bureaucracy is not about personal feelings. It's not about something's wrong with them. Does bad people somehow become union bureaucrats? It's far from that, but it's about overall circumstance that the trade union movement is in that puts pressures on these individuals to do the things that they do. And I think the way, one way that I think about it is this is similar to the way Howard Zinn talked about it. He actually was interviewed by the socialist worker after Bush came into office, and he said, there's hardly anything more important that people can learn than from the fact that it's not who's sitting in the White House, but it's who's sitting in the streets, in the cafeterias, in the halls of government, in the factories. Who's protesting, who's occupying offices and demonstrating, these are the things that determine what happens. And I think you can apply that view on who's in the White House, similar to, you know, who's happening to be sitting in the presidency or elected to the presidency of your union. It's about what's happening in the outside world that puts pressures on these individuals to do the right thing. Because the politics of the union leader certainly can make some difference, but it's not the sole determinant of what happens in the class struggle. For example, John Lewis, who was a leader in the mine workers union in the 1930s, was a staunch Republican and an anti-communist. The guy did not, wasn't some like left-wing crazy person. And he wouldn't think he'd be an unlikely candidate to spearhead the founding and the organizing of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, but that's what he did, because that's what was going on in the world at the time. And so he led the split within the AFL and unleashed a strike wave that built the CIO. And he intended to run the CIO in the same top-down manner that he ran the Mine Workers Union, which is what he came out of. But the scale of class struggle prevented him from reining in rank-and-file workers from leading strikes and factory occupations on the ground, particularly in the auto industry. So to define the rank and file perspective is partly also to define what we mean by rank and file. What we mean basically, or what I mean by that, is just workers in a workplace who are there, who are not paid by the union to supervise the operation of the union. And I think in that conception of the rank and file versus bureaucracy, it's also important not to say that somehow there's this like rank and file that's there with pitchforks in one hand and torches in the other, and the bureaucrats just standing there as a thin membrane to stop them from breaking through and overthrowing capitalism. That's clearly not the case, at least in my workplace. I don't know about other people. But it's not a homogenous body. I mean, I have some of my coworkers who have all kinds of ideas, some very left-wing, some very right-wing. And that's the nature of the working class in general. Class consciousness isn't at a place where we would like it, obviously. It has many ideas, many divisions. But the key, I think, about when we talk about the rank and file is that it has the potential to draw more radical conclusions, especially within the course of struggle. And this course of struggle does go up and it goes down. If you look at the history of the United States working class movement, there are definitely ebbs and flows. And so within that dynamic between the rank and file and their inherent interests and the bureaucracy and the pressures upon them, there's a dynamic that goes on that's important to understand. And I think that's where, as socialists, we can talk about there's space to organize and push things forward as much as possible. And I think some of those things means that we have to have structures within the union that, and the things that we, as socialists and activists, fight around. One of the important things is democracy within a union, because if you want to have rank and file control in your union, that's going to mean you have to have mechanisms by which you can express your desires. And even, unfortunately, right now, that's democracy is not a huge part of a lot of unions. And again, to draw an example from my own union, we have conventions every 2 years, now it's every 3 years, but unlike most unions, and this is, again, a radical nurses union that has all kinds of left-wing positions on single-payer health care. They support Black Lives Matter. They support voting rights, civil rights, all the rest of it. But it's still run in a very top-down way. And so at the convention 2 years ago, I attempted to bring forward a BDS resolution to the floor of the convention. And when I chartered research, like at the possibility of this, I basically learned there's no tradition around that. There's no mechanism around that. There's no participation of the members in the resolution process of the union. And so again, it's weird. You know, even AFSCME, which has even more top down, even say has actually convention that the teachers I know union have very specific spelled out mechanisms by which members can bring resolutions to the floor. But I mean, again, the only point I'm trying to make is just because you have a left-wing union doesn't mean necessarily you're going to have democracy. And it is an important thing that as rank and file workers we do have to fight for and organize. Because at the end of the day, I think a union is only as strong as its members' ability to organize on the shop floor. And that's, I think, why when we talk about trade union and class struggle unionism, what we mean is that our coworkers are organized, we're united, we're fighting around the things that we agree on need to be won. And it's not about a service model of trade unionism, or basically call up like Geico or Progressive and say, oh, my car is messed up, please come fix my car. But it's about, okay, we have a problem, how can we collectively as workers in this workplace fix it and come to an activity to make that happen. And as socialists, this actually fits with our long-term goal. We think as socialists that the act of the emancipation of the working class, as Karl Marx wrote, is the act of the working class, meaning that no one can come and liberate us for us. One of my favorite quotes is by the socialist Eugene Debs. He says, I do not be a Moses to lead you to the promised land because someone could just lead you back out. And what we mean by that is that workers have to liberate themselves, have to be participating in activity. And I think a microcosm of that should be seen in our trade union work, meaning that we see the activity of workers, the self-activity, saying that they themselves can make their workplace better. It can lead to further ideas about workers collectively, internationally, can also make the world a better place. And so that's why we think as socialists that the rank and file strategy is actually linked to that process. So there's obviously other strategies that leftists have looked to in order to influence trade union politics that are different than the rank and file strategy. One of them is orienting on getting left-wing activists elected to official positions. And that's a not uncommon thing that other people do, because the idea is that, well, if the membership is passive and if we have a different leadership, then maybe better things can happen. The leadership can call for positions or for actions or for strikes that would benefit the workers, and that would somehow lead to more activity. I think that's it's not as simple as that. If it was as simple as that, we would be in a different place. Because I think it gets back to there's a dynamic between rank and file activity and the willingness of union leadership, but also the pressures upon the leaders and unions to do the right thing. And so I think orienting on just getting someone elected to the office, it attempts to skip over or miss that step of building up that power and the rank and file. Because you can have, there's definitely examples of battles that were won with the strong rank and file under a right-wing leadership. I talked earlier about John L. Lewis organizing the CIO. He was a right-winger, but they had a huge rank and file movement. There's another example that you can look to from Russian Revolution history, Father Gapone, who organized a union and organized workers to fight against the boss, but he was actually a police agent, but that workers' movement snowballed into the 1905 revolution. And so again, another example of a right-wing leader who can organize an event, but it was because of the ingenuity and the fighting capacity of the rank and file, it went far beyond whatever he thought he was gonna do. Obviously, he wasn't trying to organize the 1905 revolution, the opposite was the case, but that can happen. So again, it comes down to the power of the rank and file. And you, in the same way you can find examples of battles won with a right-wing leader, you can find battles lost with a left-wing leader. Again, my own union was in contract negotiations with the government of Cook County, and again, it's a very left-wing union, but when we talked about having a strike, that was shut down very early on. Basically, we were told by our left-wing leadership that it's not going to be popular for nurses to go on strike, that we make too much money, we're gonna look bad, and all et cetera. And so that, even though that we pushed forward and they talk a lot about left-wing ideas, at the end of the day, they really weren't about that. And unfortunately, we didn't have enough capacity within the bargaining unit to push beyond what our organizers told us. We attempted to do that as much as possible, but weren't able to do so. And I think that's more of a sign of the overall state of labor than anything else. And so, anyway, the point being is that I think rank and file combat activity has to be the focus rather than official elections. Because a lot of times people just elect new leaders because they're sick of the old ones. It's the same way the Democrats, Republicans, they get flipped back and forth. So if we just get this other guy in, maybe it'll make our lives better. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of my coworkers look to unions. Again, it stems from that service model view of trade unions. The other way that, other than the rank and file strategy, that is sometimes looked to is the idea that we need to organize breakaway unions. Basically, the Communist International attempted this, to organize these red unions, that we can just basically abstain from trying to fight with these more conservative leaders and form new organizations. But that also never turned out to be very effective, because basically you separate yourself from your potential allies. You don't really organize and convince other workers by doing something on the other side of town. And so The rank-and-file strategy is an explicitly revolutionary strategy. It builds a militant workers' movement that's not an end to itself, but a key step on the road towards working-class self-emancipation. So just to move on to the historical examples of how this carried out explicitly, I'm gonna do a little bit of a jump from the Russian Revolution on forward through the 70s, so fasten your seatbelts. The rank-and-file approach to trade unions really started off, I think, with Lenin and the Communist International, and it was as a means to spread revolution. Broadly speaking, it didn't start beforehand because in Russia, the socialists organized the unions. It wasn't like there was some bureaucracy of unions that existed under Tsarist Russia that we had to intervene in. They organized unions and led the unions, and it, obviously the rank-and-file was a big part of that because that was their politics. In other countries, such as France, Britain, United States, there are also huge syndicalist movements, which saw the trade union movement as a revolutionary party. I know there's a talk happening, I think, right now, if people want to leave, on the syndicalist movement. And I think people should, there's this, this book kind of goes through that, Radical Unionism. On revolutionary syndicalism, but it basically they had a different conception of unions. They basically saw the revolutions as a revolutionary body in itself. They saw those two things as the same thing. And so the IWW, for example, Industrial Workers of the World in this country, they refused to sign contracts with the employer because they're like, why would we make a deal with the boss? We're about overthrowing capitalism. We don't want to make a deal with them. In any case, so at the Comintern, their goal was that they needed to figure out how do we spread revolution around the world? We had this amazing workers' revolution in Russia. We have these organizations in other countries. How do we put things forward? And in countries like this, in this country, they try to say, okay, where can we participate in existing struggle to push it forward? And that's why there was an argument around having people to get involved either in existing unions to push them more to the left and reach out and organize the revolutionary line.
You've been listening to Labor Radio, KBOO Portland, Dennis Forsooth, talking about the rank-and-file strategy in trade unions.
So kept alive, or the rank-and-file perspective was definitely kept alive by the Workers' Party. So the Workers' Party was formed by socialist organizations that led two main strikes that took place in 1934, one being the 1934 Minneapolis Teamster Strike, and the second being the Toledo Autolite Strike. In Minneapolis, the Trotskyist Communist League, who was led by James Cannon nationally, but on the ground by the Dunn brothers and later Farrell Dobbs. I'm sure people are familiar with this book, or if they haven't, they should be, Teamster Rebellion. Well, they organized basically a local 574, the Teamsters, from 75 members into a fighting union. And by fighting, I mean literally fighting, like with sticks and, you know, all the rest of it, to gain recognition. It culminated in the victorious general strike. In Toledo, Ohio, A.J. Musty and the Workers' Party intervened on behalf of a recognition strike by auto workers who were fighting for recognition of the union, and when the central labor body in Ohio attempted to help them, it didn't really work out, and so they came in as conscious socialists to try and help support the strike. And again, this was another example. There was thousands of workers involved in a huge strike. Again, you know, bullets, bottles, bricks, and tear gas were involved in the struggle for them to gain recognition. And so, again, this is another example of socialists, both the Teamsters Rebellion and the Toledo Oliver strike, of seeing the power of their rank and file, but linking that to an explicit set of politics that were not just about getting a contract, but saying we need a different world. And that was, you know, evident in how they ran their strikes. They had daily meetings, I know, in Minneapolis to talk about it. They had votes on where they continued the strike, and it brought up other social questions about, okay, so we still want to get things across the city. How are we going to do that? How are we going to feed children? How are we going to transport workers? All the rest of it. It brought all kinds of questions to the fore and radicalized the people that were involved in it. So these organizations again kind of continued that tradition. But following that, there was obviously World War II made it difficult to organize strikes on the one hand because most unions signed on to this no strike pledge. But interestingly enough, the people who were formed this workers' party continued to be strikes even during the war. And the main reason was because there was a labor shortage, in the sense that either everyone was off fighting the war or they were working in the factories. So workers had an incredible amount of power. I read somewhere that there were more strikes that took place in 1943 than in 1936 because workers felt that power to organize. And most of these were wildcat strikes. They weren't organized because you had, again, a no-strike pledge. And the Workers' Party continued to exist under the leadership of this other guy named Max Shackman. And they didn't support the no-strike pledge, even though they adhered to it in some ways. And within the UAW, organized another vote on the no-strike pledge in 1944 at their national convention, and got a third of the members through their rank-and-file caucus to vote against the no-strike pledge, saying we're anti-war workers, and we think that this war is wrong, and that's why we want to organize. Following that, the 50s did become a difficult time for socialists to organize, namely because of McCarthyism. The working socialists and communists were basically driven out of trade unions, thrown in jail, etc. And it wasn't, I think, until the mid-60s that you began to again see the reintroduction of that, just struggle as well, but also the rank-and-file perspective into union organizing. There's this guy named Stan Weir who's got this collection of essays, Single Jack Solidarity, and he was addressing the Bay Area Club of the Independent, the Bay Area meeting of the Independent Socialist Club in 1966. And he talked about the recent rank and file revolts that were taking place at the time and attributed it to the anemic leadership of the labor bureaucracy. And so Stan Weir, along with Ann Draper, who was a leader of the Young People Socialist League and the wife of Hal Draper, laid the groundwork for the rank and file orientation of the labor work of the International Socialist Club. And the International Socialist Club, which is the predecessor, one of the predecessors of this organization, took lessons when they saw the French General Strike take place in 1968 and said, okay, now obviously we can build the Workers' Party, because then people may or may not know about the French General Strike. It started with a student fight that led very quickly into workers in France marching and a general strike taking place in France. So they were like, look, now's the time to build an explicit Workers' Party, a working class revolutionary party. And the revolution and a rank and file rebellion was taking place in this country at the time, in the late 60s and early 70s. It fed off the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the anti-war movement. That was going into the workplace. And so you saw massive upturn of struggle. And that stuff is documented in books like this, Detroit, Do Mind Dying, which is, I think there's some of the authors are here this weekend as well, but it chronicles that radicalization taking place. And so the International Socialists followed the model of the Trade Union Education League. They set up national fractions around the industries they thought were key. Members got jobs in these workplaces. And it was a time of economic boom, meaning that it was easy, like if you went into a steel plant to get a job, and then say you started organizing, you got fired, you just go on the streets of all the plant because there was such a tight labor market, you can get a job and become an activist there as well. I guess it was before the days of Google, where they could just look up, you know, so-and-so's name and say, this guy's obviously a commie, we're not going to hire him. But it was the economic situation made it easier for people to kind of do that. The International Socialists started dozens of rank and file newspapers where the workers themselves would write about the different struggles that were happening. They were making arguments around class struggle, unionism, and putting forward political demands, being against the war in Vietnam, supporting affirmative action policies, talking about the need for an independent labor party. On the shop floor, they were obviously leading fights around things like innocent until proven guilty. For everyone who has a job, which is everyone here, I'm sure you know that you're guilty until proven innocent under our current disciplinary thing. And so that was a very popular thing the International Socialists put forward, saying, well, you should be innocent, just like in the courts. Another thing they put forward was there should be a steward for every supervisor. And we're far from that, I think, in most workplaces, where we have many supervisors and very not enough stewards. And they weren't about just taking union office, although sometimes they did, but building the class struggle. And if they did take union office, they were very clear with their coworkers, saying, look, if I get elected to office, you can be sure that the company and the tops at the union are going to make sure my grievances aren't going to be heard. So we're going to have to struggle together to make sure that what we're fighting for is going to be won. And other left groups at the time also had a similar orientation on the working class. It wasn't just the National Socialists, who were very small at the time, but were disproportionately effective, I think, because of their orientation on this rank and file tendency. I know that in Detroit, Do Mind Dying, they described this other group called Drum, and they had a different way of looking at, I think it was more just not, it wasn't as clear about what exactly they were trying to do. Were they a revolutionary party? Were they a pressure group on the Democrats? Were they a rank and file group? And they wasn't really quite clear what they were doing, whereas I think the International Socialists were more clear on this rank and file strategy. And they were about building a fighting union and a socialist organization at the same time. Apparently, they recruited about over 100 workers between 75 and 76, and 70 or 80 of them stuck around. One of the most important recruits was this a Teamster named Pete Camarada, who was a rank and file leader and organizer. He passed in the last few years. But they, you know, these are the people who were attracted to the set of politics that the IS had put out, and when saw the class struggle unionism as linked in with a fight for a better world, and wanted to be a part of that.
That wraps it up for this evening's Labor Radio. You've been listening to Dennis Forsooth talking about rank and file strategy and trade unions, a talk given in Chicago at the Socialism 2016 conference this July. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 o'clock for Labor Radio of the Working Class, by the Working Class, and for the Working Class. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
But first, we would love to have you be a part of KBOO and be part of this amazing grassroots organization by calling toll-free 877-500-KBOO. I am Conch. I'm here with Teresa, and we are, you know, Teresa, when I was in high school taking history class, it was all dates and names and presidents and wars, and it wasn't the least bit interesting to me, but, you know, nowadays when I listen to a historical talk like the one we just had, it's fascinating to me, all these things that could have gone one way or the other, but just for a few people getting together at a grassroots level and really working hard to change things. I know that you are a retired union member. I've never been a union member, but I have been grateful for all of the organized people who have brought up wages and living conditions, even for the folks who are not in unions. I mean, that, to me, is part of the huge social benefit that goes on. And, you know, here I think we can say KBOO is a huge social benefit to the community, and we would love to have you join us, maybe with an hour of your wages each month, by going online at kboo.fm or calling and talking to one of our cool volunteers back here. The number is 877-500-5266.
Well, Conch, this Labor Radio show is different from the Labor Radio shows that you hear on those other stations like
KETU. I feel like I'm at a Seder here. Yes.
KEX or KOPB. Wait just a darn minute. They don't have a Labor Radio program. But we do here at KBOO, and you know that's probably why you need to support us, isn't it? Because this is where you're going to hear that sort of talk. That's where you're going to hear the sort of information. 877-500-5266, 877-500-KBOO, 877-500-5266. Now, it's not going to take a lot for you to call us up. It's just going to take a few minutes. We're not high-tech here. We're just going to fill out a form and mail it to you. And it's as easy as that. It's as easy as taking 3 minutes out of your life right now and dialing 877-500-5266. We have people waiting for your call, and they'll be very happy to hear the phone ring with your pledge. I would like to thank Dale, who called in from Corvallis to join KBOO.
Yay! We love Corvallis.
Clifford from Auburn, Washington, represent Woo-hoo. Auburn. Janet from Southwest Portland. Oh, yeah, she gets a jingle, too. And renewing Mark from North Portland and Lily from Southeast Portland and Mariana from Southwest Portland. Thank you very much for joining up. And, you know, that's how we do it. That's how we remain KBOO. We remain KBOO by taking donations from you as opposed to just kind of sliding down that, oh, we need more corporate contributions hole. We refuse to go down that hole. We instead get what we need from you, and that's what keeps KBOO KBOO. I would like to encourage you to call right now, 877-500-5266, because we would like to give you KBOO's zip-up hoodie.
Yay!
The black zip-up hoodie features new artwork on the left chest that is 6 inches high. The image is of a radio tower. It's rather stylized with a red star at the top of the tower. It looks militant as hell. Everyone loves it. At the base of the tower, it says KBOO Community Radio, and this could be your hoodie. And only people, just by and large, only people who are actually contributing $20 a month, that can be you, actually get that hoodie. So you can call right now. You could up your pledge to 20 and get the hoodie that way. 877-500-5266. 877-500-KABOO. Right, Conch?
That is right. And you know, I'm old enough to remember. I've been around long enough that I can remember when PBS ran a couple of labor-centric TV shows back in the day. Once a week, there was Livelihood, there was We Do the Work. But you know, I haven't seen anything like that in years and years and years and years. Yeah, what you see is a lot of things like, oh, the business roundtable, and it's always guys who usually white, who have a vested interest in big corporate stuff. It's not like the grassroots Main Street, you know, your friendly businessman like the people who support KABOO and help us with food and in-kind donations. You know, it's these guys that are out of state. They might be out of the country. They might be on based on some island somewhere. But even the public broadcasting thinks it's only worthwhile to put those people on, and not the people who actually get your plumbing taken care of, get your lights kept on, get your streets paved, that sort of thing. That's of no interest to them, but it is of interest to KABOO, and we hope that that makes you interested in becoming a member and becoming a funder, because we certainly have expenses, but they're minimal. We are very efficient in what we do, and we are very efficient in getting the word out so that you only get these very few pledge drives a year, and you get a great opportunity during them to call toll-free 877-500-KBOO.
Call out to union members. You know who you are. I'm a member of ATU 757. Even if I am retired, I'm still a dues-paying member. I need you to call in right now, 877-552-66. Come on, we brought the weekend to the people. Let's bring KBOO Radio. 877-552-66, and back to KBOO programming.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening and welcome to Prison Pipeline. Our program tonight.